Welcome to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show and would like to hear more from us, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform. Welcome to the show, guys. Today we are joined by Chris Allen. Chris Allen is mental health strategy advisor at Two Augment and also owner of WeWork Wellbeing and, let's not forget, Chris, podcast co-host of Mind Games Podcast. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to do this. It's gonna be a great conversation. So yeah, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you for having me, Ben. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. So let's dive in at the deep end, right? So what's the service you provide, Chris? And also, what have you done with Venturi recently? Because you've been doing some work with us.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, the answer to both questions really is mental health first aid. Now, as far as I'm concerned, and I've been doing this for a long time, mental health first aid is the most robust training course for mental health that I know of. What's even better is that you can learn this through your work, but the principles that you learn are applicable across, you know, work-related scenarios, but also non-work-related scenarios. So you've got like skills from the course that are transferable. So whether the mental health first aider at Venturi is dealing with a colleague or a family member, or even, you know, a stranger they encounter on a bridge somewhere, the principles are transferable across, you know, across all disciplines.
Excellent. So, you know, in terms of business and, you know, a workforce, what are some of the key things that organizations can do, you know, to really support their employees with mental health?
Sure. I mean, I think that's a great question, and I'll cover it from a few different areas, if that's okay.
Yeah.
But a business bringing in mental health support for its employees tells their employees quite a lot. It tells them along the lines of, you know, we're there for you, the whole you. We want you as an employer, and we also want you as a person, as part of the team. It also recognizes that there is an impact on mental health, like it or not, of work. It says, you know, that we appreciate the contributions, that it's an inclusive place to be in, and we want it to be psychologically safe. But that's not all. There's a pretty large amount of risk that is not mitigated, but it helps to support, you know, things that are underpinned by legislation, things like the Health and Safety at Work Act. Mm-hmm. I'm finding in my experience working with businesses that the health and safety executive is becoming a lot more punitive in its approach towards mental risks. So whereas traditionally they've been a lot more interested in physical hazards, slips, trips, falls at work, and prosecuting businesses as a result of that, they're becoming a lot more punitive when it comes to mental health risks.
Right.
So you've got the moral argument first and foremost, and then after that, you've got the legal argument as well. So, but there's more. Still, there's the financial implications as well. You've got the work-related stress, anxiety, and depression figures that we can talk about a little bit if you want. Work-related ill health, 44% mm-hmm. is associated to stress, anxiety, and depression. And more than 50%, I think it's just below 60% actually, of working days lost are associated to mental ill health. So there's a moral, legal, and a financial reason to implement mental health related care, or not care, maybe that's the wrong word, but support within a workplace. Mm-hmm. I mean, the volume, if we're talking huge volumes of the workforce in general, it's £42 billion per year, mental ill health costs employers. So this, yeah, I mean, it's pretty staggering, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I mean, the list goes on, but there's a big argument, both moral, legal, and financial, to embed well-being related strategies as we do, you know, as you asked.
Yeah. And actually, I think depression and anxiety in the workplace is far more common than people think. I mean, one of the reasons why I think is because you can't necessarily see it. And I think people can put a front apart, they can put a front up, and it's very difficult to spot, but I think it's far more common than people initially think. I mean, do you think that too?
I'm a fully signed up card carrying member of belief in that principle. It's absolutely true. The figures and the numbers that we have to some extent are quantifiable, you know, the impact on business. It's a quantifiable figure based on reports, but it all is based on reports. So what percentage of the workforce are taking time off for stomach upset, flu, cold, which are actually related to sickness absence for depression, anxiety reasons? You know, there's a lot of people that I meet clinically who've got long list of, you know, physical ailments, but in reality, a lot of it is actually mental in nature, and they just feel that there's a stigma and it is a discrimination, and they don't want their boss to know that they live with depression.
Yeah.
So I think your point is that we find it difficult to actually quantify the impact, and the numbers that I've given paint a picture, but you're right. You're absolutely right, Ben. It's not the whole picture at all.
Yeah. Do you think as well that we've still got a long way to go? You know, are there still a lot of businesses that aren't really supporting their employees through mental health? I mean, I've heard some horror stories, and definitely I've worked in businesses where they almost brush their, you know, I've seen it so bad sometimes where you can physically see someone's mentally unwell and they just kind of ignore it entirely. I mean, that's a horror story, but that's just one example.
I'm very accustomed to going into businesses and people speaking in hushed tones about something bad that's happened, and that's why I'm present. It's not the be all and end all, but it's not every single case that I'm, you know, called in, really not to solve a problem, but to deliver some training, which is going to be part of the solution to the problem overall.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's often reactionary. So, and I think that's what you're asking. You're talking about horror stories. These horror stories do exist. And most often I am being called in as part of, you know, a string of the solution to that problem, because it's no longer acceptable to just kind of brush it under the carpet, pretend it's not there, or, you know, hope that it'll go away.
Mm. Yeah,
does that answer the question?
It definitely does. And you touched upon a point there, which really interests me. As you know, you were saying often your work is reactive rather than preventative. Mm. And I think that's, it's almost businesses, they tend to wait until something drastic has happened before they call for help, rather than preventing that happening in the first place and setting those foundations there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was an article that came out in Forbes about 2 weeks ago that says along the lines of more than 93% of managers are concerned because they're watching the bottom line evaporate as a result of the mental health crisis that is arising from the pandemic. Really worth checking. You can find it real easily. If anyone wants to, you know, check my understanding or check my details here. It's all you have to Google is Forbes 93% managers mental health. And you'll find the article that I'm talking about. I mean, it's becoming an issue that really requires businesses to step up and tackle. Traditionally, you know, your mental health didn't affect your work. And that was the perception traditionally. You know, it was, you just get on with it, regardless of what's going on in your life. You just get on with the job. But it's getting to the point now where, first of all, I think people want more from their employers when it comes to the, you know, what they value. They want to be felt. They want to feel like they're being cared for, appreciated, listened to, understood. And part of that is, you know, the equality stuff that we can talk about. But part of it as well is to do with, you know, the concept of bringing your whole self to work.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. And you mentioned COVID there, and I think we kind of have to talk about that. And I was just interested in your opinion.
Mm.
Would you say that, you know, since the pandemic, obviously more people have suffered mentally. Would you do you think that it's to kind of put a spotlight or a magnifying glass on, you know, mental health awareness in the workplace since COVID? Do you think it's become more, you know, made employees more aware?
Yes, and there's two reasons for that. However, to give credit where it's due, I do think that there's been a movement towards understanding. I've been working clinically for a very long time now, and in the past decade, I've noticed rates of disclosure have gone up. So whereas I would be writing medical reports about employees saying they live with a health condition, now I'm writing those reports that say this person lives with anxiety and depression, and here is the impact.
Wow.
So yeah, disclosure is improving. So give credit where it's due. People are becoming more sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? More sort of lucid in their understanding of mental health. Part of that might be just because there's been a drive nationally. Things like mental health first aid exist. Things like Mental Health Awareness Week exist. Mm-hmm. There's that. But second to that as well, my work is rooted in mental health for the most part. And so when you're asking me, has it boomed? I would say, yes, it has. But it's different now.
Mm.
It's different now because the people that were being furloughed, put, you know, on work from home, a lot of them are struggling. And so there's a like almost like a new variant of mental ill health that's arising as a result of the pandemic. We've got people struggling with grief, loss, divorce. The effects that it's had on society are trickling down and cannot not be magnified upon the individual. Does that make sense?
It totally does. Yeah, it totally does. It's quite, you know, it's been needless to say, it's been a terrible year for mental health. But, you know, what I've found is in a lot of workplaces, you know, since we've come out of the pandemic and people have been going back into the office, and it's almost like I can imagine a lot of workplaces expecting their employees just to go straight back into work full time as if nothing's happened. And that kind of surprises me a bit because, you know, we've been through a very, very mentally tough year. And then to expect people to be able to just go straight back into work full time, full levels, do the best work they've ever done, it just seems a bit crazy to me. I just think it seems a bit hard, you know, it's a bit tough. I don't know. Maybe it's just me that needs warming into things and I'm, you know, but I don't know. What do you think?
I don't think it is. And I think there's definitely a healthy debate to be had. The government a couple of weeks ago, I haven't heard anything since then, but they were examining how working from home, or flexible working, actually, it was more flexible working, can be mandated so that there's no sort of you get it, you don't get it. You get it because you're a parent. You don't get it because you've got anxiety.
Yeah.
There's no like judgment required. It's enshrined in law. They might have a tricky time coming up against, you know, their business leaders that are, you know, within their party, etc. But it's an interesting conversation to be had. And I think that is the core element of managing this particular problem, this return to normal anxiety, if that's the right, you know, turn of phrase. Mm. The, you know, unlocking fear, or the, you know, restrictions lifting worries that people have. It's conversation. I think people need to feel heard and understood and trusted, because you know what? They were trusted to get their work done throughout the pandemic from home. And now that restrictions are being lifted, that trust has seemingly evaporated in many circumstances, not all, but many.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting as well? I mean, I've found that, you know, people working from home, I've had a lot of leaders on the podcast who, you know, have huge teams, and they say that people's productivity when they worked from home is actually, you know, can be a lot higher than...
Yeah, I think what I've noticed when it comes to productivity is people feel a real strong, or they did at the very beginning at least, but people felt a really strong need to prove that they were working. And so what was happening then was they were foregoing things like breaks,
absolutely,
foregoing things like exercises. So exercise, they were foregoing, you know, lots of the really good self-care stuff that I preach all the time. If anyone out there has listened to my podcast, and I know you have, Ben, you'll know that I'm a real advocate for personal responsibility for one's self-care. Mm-hmm. And that was the biggest issue I think I was running into early in the pandemic, that, you know, there's an awful lot of stuff on social media about, you know, let's bake bread, let's do all these things. But concurrently, there also seemed to be a lot of people who weren't doing that and were just throwing themselves into work. And I think this idea of being more productive at home has been prevalent even before the pandemic for those people that have worked from home maybe a day, 2 days a week. They feel a real sense of urgency to demonstrate very well that they're working productively at home and they're not just sitting with their feet up. That's been a prevalent, from my experience, prevalent experience for sure.
That is so interesting, because I've definitely fallen into that category before.
Have you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's such a strange feeling though, isn't it? Because it feels like, I don't know, it feels like there's a magnifying glass on you, like monitoring what you do, even though that absolutely won't be. But you almost have to overprove yourself because you're not being seen.
Yeah, just so you can skip the commute and be comfortable and, you know, be with your children at the end of the day without, you know, having to do that commute once again in order to get there. That's one of the, you know, benefits for me anyway of working from home. I'm here, and then as soon as, you know, my work's done, I'm with the family. It's great. Yeah. That's one of the unintended benefits.
Yeah. And you know, like you were saying, but people's productivity goes higher, but that's because they feel, you know, anxiety to prove themselves, you know. I think that'll change over time when people get more used to working from home. Or do you think that's deep set? Is that just one of the things?
Clinically, I've seen a lot of people who have just burnt out because of it. They've just, you know, hit a brick wall.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're coming to me and I'm asking questions like, where's the boundary? Yeah. What do you mean you're working till 11 o'clock? I mean, that's necessary for some people sometimes, but consistently, there's a problem there that requires management. Hmm. You know, there's a health issue, and I can advise and discuss and talk about these things with people, and with the right sort of level of medico-legal consent, communicate that back to the organization or the line manager. But like I was talking about with self-care, you know, there's a need for imposing barriers. And it's very easy for me to sit here and say that when, you know, there's someone in a business who's responsible for coordinating the purchase receipt and dispatch of, you know, 100 computers for their workforce. It's very easy for me to say that, but, you know, there is management requirements here as well when it comes to people's workload and what's reasonable. And, you know, while, you know, dashing through to like get your work done on a Friday at 1 a.m., it happens. It's happened to me. But when it becomes, when it comes down, I always like to think about it in terms of impact. Mm. What's the impact of you doing that? What's the impact of you overworking? It's kind of, we need to think about what the impact on your life is as a result of that. Does it mean that you miss your daughter's bedtime? Does it mean that, you know, you're not connecting with your friends? You have to miss that Zoom call that you've scheduled on a Friday night with your friends to reconnect. What are you losing as a result of this? Where's the impact, and what's that going to have in the longer term if that sort of behavior continues?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's really, really interesting, isn't it? I mean, it's almost like putting work on a pedestal, isn't it? And, you know, forgetting about life, because I think we've been conditioned to do that for so long.
Well, yeah, there's part of it's conditioning. Part of it is, you know, the concept that I've spoken about a few times now on various podcasts is the hustle culture.
Yeah.
This idea that you're always at peak performance level, which is completely unsustainable in the long run. Peak performance level is a fight or flight survival, isn't it? You can't maintain that for a long time. And the reason is because it's supposed to get you out of danger. Now, the modern world doesn't have bears chasing after you, you know, or tigers coming for you in a savannah, but being provoked to be at peak level at all times, like a lot of these sort of business and self-care gurus, self-improvement gurus, not self-care gurus, but a lot of these sort of people like, Tim Ferriss talks about functioning at peak level, but of course, like, he also preaches that whole concept of taking time out as well with the mini retirement. But this idea that you will always be functioning at your optimum, it's just unrealistic.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And I imagine it to be like a sliding scale of, you know, some people can work, you know, I feel that some people can work solidly for, you know, much longer periods of time than I can. And I feel that I need breaks more regularly than probably the most other people. But I don't know, is it kind of like, there's no blanket way to say this is how you should work, essentially, is there?
No, and I think what we can consider is that principle of the impact. So if you don't take breaks, Ben, if you're not taking those breaks that you need, you're not getting the air, you're not getting the sun, you're not eating, you're not drinking enough water, etc., what's the impact going to be? And when we think about things like stress, people, depending on who you are, you know, how you came up, what you're made of, all of those things, people have different sized levels of, like, sort of containers, if you like, capacity for stress.
Yep.
But it's when that capacity is reaching its fullest point that, you know, it's time for a de-stress break. It's time for some of that self-care stuff to be enacted upon. And the line is different for everybody. And can we make that container bigger? I wonder. I think with, you know, a really good, robust self-care strategy, you can handle more stress is the answer. But I'm not 100% convinced that it is possible. But if different people have got different capacity for stress. Yeah. I mean, I think that's the takeaway from that bit, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah, that was, yeah, very interesting. And Ricky, you've mentioned self-care a few times. And what are some of the things that you can do to kind of, you know, implement self-care into your daily life?
Sure. Well, from my experience of working with people on a regular basis and talking to people about mental health, the thing that is missing is self-care. So what do I mean by self-care is the question, I suppose. Bottling up emotions, not talking to your friends or people you trust, self-medication with things like alcohol, drugs, and just a general lack of regard for oneself. The way I like to describe it to people is like you work out, you do cardio exercises for well-being, like for your cardiovascular system. You eat healthy for your physical well-being. You know that you're supposed to do these things, but when was the last time you thought about what you're required to do for your physical, for your mental well-being? Have you ever asked yourself, you know I'm supposed to exercise, I know I'm supposed to eat well, I do those things for my health. What about your mental health? Do you, on a regular basis, engage in some of these self-care practices? Because what I noticed is very broadly, we don't negotiate with ourselves before we brush our teeth in the morning. Mm-hmm. We just do it. It's just an automatic self-care habit because we don't like the pain of toothache. So we do it and we've done it every day since we've had teeth. But what do you do on a regular basis for your mental health care, you know? You know, I talk to people about difficult situations almost all my clinical practice, almost all my life. And it used to weigh heavy on my soul. It did. It used to be a thing that I carried with me. But I've developed really robust self-care practices in order to protect myself from that. And I'm constantly questioning people, asking people about when or how or what are you doing in order to improve your self-care. But I've got it's like a secret weapon. I call it the recharge power hour of greatness.
Well, that sounds amazing.
it is. And I promise you, it's absolutely legendary. You will feel absolutely legendary after you've done it. And the secret to the whole thing is it's 1 hour of self-care activities every single day.
Right.
Whether it's meditation, whether it's journaling, whether it's your exercise. If anyone doubts me about this idea that you're going to feel absolutely legendary after the recharge power hour of greatness, do it for a week. I challenge you, all the listeners, to do it for a week and see how you feel. Prove me wrong. Just do it for a week and see.
Yeah. Oh, amazing. Well, I'm definitely going to do that. Definitely. I mean, you must find it frustrating though when people say, when you mention things like this to people and say, oh, I haven't got time. You know,
it happens all the time.
What do you say to those people?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Well, the other thing that happens all the time before I answer that question is, so what are you doing? Oh, I've got the meditation app on my phone. Oh, really cool. Which one is it? It's like Headspace. I'm like, oh, that's really good. The foundation course is great. I love Headspace. I think it's fantastic. When was the last time you used it? Oh, I don't know, but it's on the phone.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a lot of these sort of lies that we tell ourselves about what we're doing to improve our health. But the question was, wasn't it? How do I deal with people that tell me they've got no time? Well, often I reflect it back. Like, you're here to talk to me for a reason. You're here because you've got poor mental health. And part of that, not the whole equation, but part of that is because of some of the choices you've made in terms of what your priorities are.
Right.
If you change your priorities, different results will follow.
Yeah, exactly. And it is finding balance, isn't it? You know, and it's really, really easy for that balance to become, you know, to shift one way too far. I mean, you know, if you're going out 3 or 4 nights a week to the pub, but you're still trying to maintain work and you're not getting enough sleep, it's so easy for that to kind of happen. You're socializing too much. If, you know, if you're a person that, you know, is maybe as introverted and likes their own time, but also going against your own your own self to socialize and be, you know, that happens all the time. And then it's really easy to get drained and burned out in those situations, but it's about finding that balance. And I think personally for me, that's come with age. I'm realizing and noting that these things are happening, you know, and turning down opportunities because you know that you need to recharge essentially. What are your thoughts on that?
I completely agree. Balance is key. So I'm reminded of one experience I had with a client who had read on the internet that exercising was the solution for mm-hmm. stress. You know, if you go and you Google now, like how to de-stress or, you know, what's good for your well-being, you'll be bombarded with millions of web pages, 50 tips to improve your mental health, you know, 10 best ways to do your well-being strategy. Yeah. All of these things will come up. And this person took it very seriously and started exercising. But the exercise went too far to the point where he was taking his tent with him on his back while he was going jogging and sort of camping over the weekends, jogging more tomorrow, wow. and completely burnt out, completely physically. And so he was incredibly stressed at work, had a very, very high-powered executive level job, which was very, very stressful. But then was doing more physical stress on top of the emotional or the mental stress at the weekends. And that person is now back on track, but they live with chronic fatigue. And for a while afterwards, it was really touch and go about whether they'd be able to do any work at all, let alone work at the same level. So when we talk about balance, it's very important. I think of my own self-care, which, you know, I meditate a lot. And the longest meditation I've ever done is 6 hours.
Wow.
But if you disappear up in the sky or in your head, for your own head, for that length of time, where's the balance? Your family, you know, my family need me. My children will forget my name. My wife will divorce me if I just spend the whole time with my head in the clouds. So we do have to find a balance. And mm-hmm. this is the counterbalance to what you're saying. Like, overwork requires balance. Of course it does, but so does the other side, because we've got bills to pay. We exactly. live in a world that requires work for the large proportion of us. Financial reward for that work.
Yeah.
So this, you've got to get balanced. You're absolutely right.
Oh God, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, it's so, it makes you realize it's so personal, isn't it? Everyone's yeah. balance is different. Everyone's life situation is different.
I mean, to reflect back on one of the questions you asked earlier on was, what do you do when people tell you that they haven't got time? Well, that's just the first layer of it. What do I do? Another question could be, what do I do when I've seen the person, they've come back a month or 3 months later to talk to me again and they've done nothing with, you know, the good stuff that I've told them to do? Well, that's where I had to learn to develop coaching skills. And I went on a fantastic course centered around the concept of motivational interviewing, which is actually a clinical practice that's used in addiction treatment centers.
Right.
Yeah, so it's about influencing for positive behavior change.
Mm.
So that's where I took my own practice in order to try and influence people to make positive behavior change when it comes to things like work, when it comes to things like stress and depression and anxiety from the work point of view. Got to remember, the point of view that I'm dealing with is a lot of people in work. So they're fully, you know, they're functioning.
Yeah.
Maybe they're overwhelmed. They're still coming to work, and using that principle of blunt force trauma, just get it done. Very, very common in business, get it done. And as I said already, you know, hustle culture, the media, this social media especially, and those sort of Instagram things about, you know, hustle culture stuff just really doesn't sit well with me. So using different ways and methods, I went on a path that's not really sort of my discipline, but in order to affect change in individuals
right.
for their own benefit, it was required, I think, to go and find what makes, you know, some of these really persuasive business people so persuasive.
Yeah.
What makes people do marketing? What makes people do the things that, you know, a business, an individual, a salesperson wants them to do? And I just had to learn that stuff and deploy it through the prism of behavior change for good wow. mental health and physical health.
Wow, it's amazing. why do you think people are so reluctant, you know, to spend time looking after themselves? I mean, I've seen it before, you know, if I've got a friend who says they're really struggling mentally, and I will advise, by no means am I a mental health advisor, but I've meditated for many years now, but off and on. But anyway, I'll always recommend you should absolutely try and just do 10 minutes of meditation a day or an activity that makes you feel, mindful. But then I can't understand why people are so reluctant to give it a go.
Well, maybe the concept of meditation or the concept of self-care feels selfish to some people.
Right.
Maybe it feels pointless. They've got stuff to do.
Mm.
But what people don't realize is that stuff to do will get done much quicker and more productively and to a higher standard if the person that's doing it is entering into that task with a, really good, robust sort of start to the day, if you like.
Yeah.
Talk about meditation. I have as well. I've dressed it up differently for different people. So for, an IT professional, I might talk about how, when you've got that cyclical sort of loop on your computer, when it's going round and round and round, and, you've got to shut down the computer, or what's the other option? Because you can't shut down your brain. Open the task manager and start closing down some of those tasks. Mm. The way you present it, I think, the letter is important, but the envelope is even more important. The way the message is delivered to people matters. Again, meditation is not for everybody. So what is it? I've gone into businesses before where people just sort of look me in the eye and go, mental health's not real. I just go for a run and I feel better. I'm like, cool, well, man, that works for you. But what happens, say, if you break your leg or if you slip over and you hurt your knee and you can't run for a week? What's your solution going to be to that problem? So stuff like this comes up, but not everything is for everybody. I get it. Meditation is pushed and there's lots of businesses that are using meditation effectively for profit, but also for the benefit of their staff. I meet lots of businesses where things like Headspace and Calm are entirely free for their staff. There's a subscription that's paid. Mm-hmm. That's great. But what else are we doing? Are we, encouraging physical exercise? Are we encouraging walking meetings? Are we encouraging, people to take their breaks?
Yeah.
It's basic, it's fundamental. Like, take your breaks, get out there. Yeah, that's from the individual point of view. Yeah. I wonder if you're going to ask me about things from a more sort of wider perspective, like from the what can businesses do, or what can a director or a leader or a supervisor do for their team or for their business or for their whole organization that would work? And I think just the answer to that is having sort of well-being on the agenda.
Mm-hmm.
So having it at a macro level for everybody, but then also having it individual. So having it on the agenda for team meetings or all staff meetings, these sort of things, how can we help your well-being? Just start asking some of those really simple, important questions and respond. Do the well-being surveys, the pulse surveys, how are you feeling? What do you need? And then those conversations can be had with the smaller teams about, right, what are we going to do about health and about mental health? They can be well-leaded, I think, personally, by a mental health first aider. They received the knowledge and the skills in order to have those conversations with people, but they also have a broader understanding of things like stigma and discrimination and the societal and individual risk factors that move someone into mental ill health and move them out of it as well. So what can a business do? And then beyond that, at the micro level, you've got the individual. So at your one-to-ones with your boss, at your sort of appraisals, include well-being as part of that. It's just some free stuff that people can do like right now. Beyond that as well, just like having it as part of the return to work interview, like having it enshrined as part of the procedure. Like, you've been off sick for, 2 weeks with a broken leg. But can I ask, like, how's your well-being been? You've been disconnected from people. Maybe they live in a basement flat and they couldn't get out and they couldn't see their friends and they were isolated alone. Talk about mental health with your workforce. People worry about saying the wrong thing. But if it comes from the right place, I think it's largely impossible, unless you're calling someone a wacko or a schizo or a freak, it's really impossible to say the wrong thing if it's coming from the right place of care and compassion.
It definitely. And it's almost like people, it seems that people are almost not scared, but kind of tentative to approach it, because it feels like I imagine for some people, it might feel like a taboo topic to say,
yeah,
to broach the issue or broach the topic because it's something that we haven't really spoken about before, you know, as much as we are trying to now. So I can imagine businesses, especially kind of certain businesses like sales and places like that, where they really kind of juggling to get through to break that seal, you know, and then really open up that door for a conversation, if that makes any sense at all, Chris.
It really does, actually. Yeah, it really, really does. And part of what I do with the mental health first aid training is, okay, so I've been delivering this since 2014. I got trained to deliver it for an employer. But I didn't launch into business until 2018, the end of 2018. And one of the reasons for that was because I've got a lot of experience in training now. I've, you know, gotten to a level that I'm very comfortable with in terms of like it's expert now, expert level delivery. But what I was seeing was lots of people were coming to me and saying, can you do this for my business? You know, I was invited to go and speak to places like the health and safety executive about things like this. And they were, and people, delegates were coming to me and saying, I want you to train my people. And I was like, you can just go on the MHF England website and find someone. They're like, no, we want you. And I was like, oh, okay, fine. And what I was seeing when I got out in the marketplace, when I surveyed the marketplace, was that there's lots of people delivering this training and that's it. And businesses were being encouraged, if you like, to provide this as a tick box exercise. And it is absolutely not a tick box. It needs to be part of a unified whole. So my space in the market was delivering the training, but also going, right, here's everything else you need to think about as well. And here's all the documents I prepared for you. Here's all the policies. Here's everything. And you know what else? Here's the after sales support. Here's the meetings that I can do with your mental health first aiders. Because you know what? It all gets a bit fuzzy after 2 months, doesn't it?
Yeah.
What was the last training course you did? And if it was longer than like 2 months ago, do you still remember the finer details? And by the way, this isn't just, you know, about content creation, or this isn't just about IT skills training. This is actually helping people's lives.
Yeah.
So why don't I plug that hole in the market, fill in those gray areas, and try and help provide for businesses what's lacking? Because the training is one thing and qualifying your mental health first aiders is great. But then after that, everyone's sort of looking around at each other going, what do we do now? And so guiding people through that process as well has been really where my skills, my business has really, you know, flourished in that sense.
Yeah, amazing. And, you know, in terms of businesses, what are the most common issues that you see from people?
See from people is the lack of self-care. That's the main thing. Yeah. And that's the thing that I'm most often talking to people about. Now, of course, self-care is not going to solve every issue under the sun when it comes to mental health. I will always be talking to people when the need arises, when I've done my sort of assessment of the need to talk to their GP, to engage with the counseling service that is available through their employer if they have one, to, you know, be making strides towards getting the professional help as well, because self-care gets you so far. It gets you so far, and it is always going to be required. It's a daily habit. It's a practice. It never goes away, like brushing your teeth, unless, you know, you get old and they've all fallen out. And it's, yeah, but you're always going to need to look after yourself regardless. All right. And if that can get you up to one line, but it's still not enough, then you need to be talking to things like GP. You know, professional help is really important. But when it comes to businesses, levels of stress are the problem. Understaff are the problem. These are not easily rectified by someone like me. But so often what I'm doing is supporting individuals and supporting supportive individuals, if that makes sense, to prop up the people that make up the business and make it what it is.
Yeah, brilliant. And I was just thinking, you know, it is brilliant, Chris, honestly.
Oh, thank you.
And, you know, this might be a bit of a naive question, but, you know, like I said, I don't know a great deal about mental health, but it seems to me that it's more apparent in the younger generations rather than the older generations. You know, first of all, is that true or not true at all?
No, I think there is definitely more awareness and conversation happening amongst the younger crowd. I think that action is relieving the stigma and discrimination around it.
Right.
but it's been there and it's been ingrained. This stigma and discrimination, it's been there for a while, and people have not felt that they've been able to talk out about or speak out about it and get the help they need. It's still now, amongst many people, something that they worry and fear about disclosing to their manager or talking about their manager for obvious reasons. I mean, are you familiar with the concept of presenteeism?
No, I've done it.
Okay, presenteeism. Presenteeism has become more of an issue really for businesses since 2008, I would say, when the financial crash happened. But presenteeism can be defined as the principle when people come to work when they're not well enough. So you will have encountered this in your life where you or someone you know has come to work even though they've got a cold or the flu because they just have to. They just, can't possibly take sick time. But that's what the concept of presenteeism is. When you come to work when you're not well, and it is very rife with things like stress, anxiety, depression, people come to work regardless. Sometimes it's helpful for them to have that distraction from whatever's going on in their life, but it affects productivity similarly to sickness absence. And so businesses have been struggling with this for a while, and more so since 2008 when the financial crash happened, because everyone was afraid of losing their jobs. Yep. And what did we see during the pandemic? Lots of people were afraid of losing their jobs. So they're even more incentivized to put their head down and get on with it and not talk about what their problems are, because if I make a fuss, I might get fired or I might be next in line for redundancy.
Well, it's a sad situation, really, isn't it? So, you know,
people do feel very insecure, and I do think that the younger generation that are coming through now have different values, different priorities, and expectations of work, and that's been my experience through many consultations with those younger people, but also many of my conversations with business leaders who, and you know, executives and people at a higher level that are seeing them coming through and saying, it's almost like a different species. Like people, they communicate differently. They've got different expectations to the generation that I'm from. And I don't know what to do and I'm afraid. But it can only be a good thing, surely, if it provokes change in the positive.
I speak a lot about diversity and inclusion in the workspace, and people nowadays, I can't remember the exact statistic, but it was probably, I think it was about 65% of, you know, young people. This is a very vague statistic, but the point, the message comes across. I think it was like 65% of, you know, millennials who are joining a business actively look for diversity and inclusion in the workplace as a selling point. And I think in the future it will be diversity, inclusion and well-being. You know, it's something that will definitely be important there.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, beyond everything that you've already said, it's really difficult. And I know, because I've been there, it's really difficult to try and enact these changes from the bottom up. The more people with these values and principles that are entering the market and demanding it, the more people at the top will have to take notice. But just, you know, looping it back to some of the challenges that businesses have and the ways that mental health first aid has been well implemented, and from my experience, the way it hasn't been, senior buy-in always helps. I mean, we can talk about, you know, the workforce who are coming up through the ranks, but the people that are already at the top, so much easier when you can do it top down. I think it's all about communication. Yep. There's a bit of role modeling in there as well when it comes from leadership, from the wider company cultures and things like this. But the magic happens, the real secret weapon when it comes to this is if you can get a senior leader to endorse it. But the extra like pro tip that I would give people is if you've got someone really brave at the top who's willing to show some vulnerability, it just sets the standard for everybody else. Oh, wow, like the director or the CEO or the COO. Do you see that video about Wellbeing Week? Do you see that it was being endorsed by so-and-so? And you know, people feel that they are now more incentivized, and it's part of the language that they can use at work. It will feel risky, trust me, for someone to lay themselves bare in that way. But that's really where the magic and the reward comes for the whole of the business. When someone in a position of leadership show some vulnerability and fully endorse this, in something like mental health first aid or you know, something to do with their well-being. That's the real sort of hack, if you like. If people like to talk about life hacks at the moment, that's a nice business hack to try and get people sort of on board, if you like. It's really important.
Definitely. And you know, I've got a couple more points to make before we before we go, but what do you think of the phrase that is thrown around in job adverts everywhere, which is work hard, play hard?
I haven't seen that in a job advert for a while, actually. That's a really good question. I think how can we possibly balance work and life and, you know, the need for sleep and all of these things if we're expecting everyone to work hard, play hard? And I think in my experience anyway, whenever I've worked hard, life kind of ends up sucking. And so it's really difficult to actually play hard because you've got no energy, you've got no motivation, you've got no get up and go about you if you're not doing, you know, the real work-life balance stuff. I would much, much prefer to see, you know, good work-life balance encouraged over the work hard, play hard principles. I know it's, you know, a part of it will be from the young workforce, of course, and I was young once as well, going out there and, you know, having my fun, etc. But there does come a time where you have to quantify it, I suppose. I don't want to put a dampener on the party because self-care is a lot of fun, but you've got to quantify what the impact is. Like you were talking about, if you're going out four nights a week and you are playing really hard as well as working really hard, there is going to be a break in the chain at some point and something is going to falter. And whether that is, you know, your well-being, your need for rest and recuperation, or it's your work and you're going to end up with time off sick and that's going to, you know, impact things then, which by the way, I'm a full believer in taking time off sick. But when it's a lifestyle choice where you're going out regularly and you're drinking, we need to look up below that. What is driving the need for someone to feel to do that? Is work not fulfilling? Is work too stressful? And this is your way of, you know, relieving those stressful feelings. Okay, well, what else works? You know, 6 pints of beer, I'm sure, feels great at the time, but when you get drunk, you're just stealing happiness from tomorrow, aren't you? So you're gonna have that ping back at some point, whatever it is you're doing.
I've not heard that before.
What,
stealing happiness from tomorrow?
It works though, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's true. Well, I mean, we can't leave the podcast without mentioning your own podcast, Chris, which you're co-host of, which is Mind Games podcast.
Yeah, thank you.
It is absolutely fantastic. I'm actually a huge fan. So, you know, it's brilliant.
Thank you.
I stick it on, you know, it's brilliant. So where can people find that if they want to check that out?
Yeah, sure. Well, if you look on all your platforms like Spotify or your podcast player and you type in Mind Games, you'll find it. It will probably be helpful to you, I suppose, if I give you the link, link for the show notes. That would probably be a good idea, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Mind Games, Mind Games UK, you will always find it. It's written Mind Games. It's got a blue logo and there's a sun at the top of the eye and there's a moon at the bottom of the eye. That's how to find us. But what I will say about it is this: I've been having these conversations with people for a long time, like even, you know, over a decade, people like yourself, Ben, individuals, larger groups. And the thing that they keep telling me is, you should have a podcast. And it's like, oh, another idiot with a podcast. But I mean, that's what it is. I've, you know, come through. I think we've nailed a beautiful format now. We did a whole bunch of them that are never released and maybe one day they'll come out as part of the archives or something like that. But I mean, I've been talking about mental health in the public eye for a long time now. It just feels like it's a natural progression. You know, last episode a while back, we spoke about Naomi Osaka, who is taking time out of her tennis career to prioritize her mental health.
Wow.
Other times we've spoken about other things that are going on, like that Forbes article with the managers who are watching their bottom line evaporate. But then we've also got the opportunity for people to ask me questions, can write in for Q&As. Like last topic of discussion was, what do we do about toxic workplaces? And then beyond that, we've got an in-clinic segment where what some of those questions that we get from the audience, we blow up a little bigger. And it's meant to be the opportunity for people to get the benefit of my experience when it comes to clinical practice. It doesn't just have to be individuals' health, though. We've spent a lot of time today talking about what businesses can do to improve their workforce mental health. So people can write in and ask us questions there. And I will tell you the email address as well.
Sure.
I want to make sure that I get it absolutely right. It's askmindgamesuk@gmail.com. And we do get questions. They're pretty cool questions. We can't answer all of them, but we will endeavor to pick out the very best and the ones that, you know, can reflect the best knowledge that I've got for everybody and all the listeners. So ask us a question and we'll open it up and go from there.
Superb. I'll put all the links to which you just mentioned in the notes of the podcast below. I genuinely could talk to you all day, Chris. I really, really could.
We can do it again one time if you want.
Absolutely. Yeah. That'll be brilliant. But let me just thank you for coming on the show. I've really enjoyed this conversation. I've been looking forward to it for a long time. As you know, I'm a fan of your podcast, so I knew it would be interesting. So yeah, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Ben.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show, give us a follow on your favorite streaming platform.